Talk Murder to Me, a true crime tour, is coming to the Denver, Colorado area Thursday, February 10th through Sunday, February 13th. Join the hosts of your favorite true crime podcasts on an all-star panel of true crime experts discussing some curious cases. You'll be joined by Cults, Crimes, and Cabernet, True Consequences, True Crime IRL, and Generation Y. And you'll be enjoying this true crime chat in some pretty cool venues while sipping on craft beers, cocktails, and wine. You can search for the event on Eventbrite by typing in Talk Murder to Me, a True Crime Tour, or you can go to my website, truecrimeirl.com/events, to get all the details and links to buy your tickets. You're not going to want to miss this one-of-a-kind event coming to Colorado in February 2022. And until then, well, you know the drill. Lock your doors, people. I'll see you soon. Bye-bye.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
Hey everybody, welcome to season 2 of True Crime IRL, True Crime in Real Life. This is a new limited series called The Manchester Mysteries. You'll still be getting real life stories of crime and unsolved cases, but all wrapped up in a very different package. This season, I'm concentrating on the captivating stories that have come out of one particular small Midwestern town called Manchester. Manchester is both weird and wonderful, with a full cast of interesting characters who have some unique stories to tell. I'll be presenting you with tales of murder, mayhem, and crimes of passion. And I'll be bringing you everything from missing persons cases to questionable suicides, and even a homicide that went unsolved for 40 years. There'll be an element of local folklore to some of our tales, but also a healthy dose of science, DNA technology, forensics, history, government, law, and so much more. And yes, it's all out of one little community in small town America. If you think you had our country's heartland all figured out, well, guess again, because I'll be bringing you stories this season that would make Ted Bundy blush. Season 2 of True Crime IRL, The Manchester Mysteries, debuts January 14th, 2022, and is available everywhere you get your podcasts. Until then, lock your doors, people, even if, or especially if, you live in Manchester. Bye-bye. You're listening to Season 2 of True Crime IRL, The Manchester Mysteries. Although this series is based 100% on factual events, keep in mind that at times we've changed the names of people or places in order to protect the innocent, or in some cases, the guilty. Episode 4, The Prosecution and the Defense. So as we know, on December 19th, 2018, exactly 39 years to the day of Michelle Martinko's slaying, Jerry Burns was arrested and charged with first-degree murder. He pleaded not guilty. Investigators say Burns claimed he did not have any recollection of committing this crime, but he could not explain why his DNA showed up at the crime scene. Since there's no death penalty in Iowa, Burns was facing a life sentence without parole. On the jury sat 7 women and 5 men who would decide the 66-year-old grandfather's fate. The prosecution side was headed by the young and handsome Linn County attorney, Nick Maybanks. In his 30-minute opening statement on day one of the trial, May Banks would give a powerful argument that the male DNA in Michelle's car and on Michelle's dress had only a 1 in 100 billion percent chance of belonging to anyone other than Jerry Burns. That's more than the entire world's population many times over. It looked like there was solid evidence putting Jerry Burns in Michelle Martinko's car for this brutal attack. Let's hear what Nick Maybanks had to say.
Please be seated, everyone. Good morning, ladies and gentlemen of the jury. We have reached the stage in the proceedings where the attorneys will have an opportunity to give what's called an opening statement. The state will go first, the defense will then go second. So with the opening statements, the attorneys will try to paint with a rather broad brush to give you that framework on which you can hang the evidence as it comes in and make some sense of it. But at this point, I'll just remind you that this is not evidence, but pay attention. The attorneys are going to do their best to tell you the story of how they believe that the evidence will come in over the next couple of weeks. Without any further delay, Mr. Maybanks or Mr. Harris, do you wish to give an opening on behalf of the state of Iowa?
Yes, sir.
Okay. You may proceed.
Ladies and gentlemen, over the course of the next 2 weeks or so, you're going to go on a journey back in time. The evidence in this case will take you to the year 1979, specifically 6 days before Christmas, December 19th, 1979. Michelle Martinko was a girl out on the town. She was young. She was just a senior in high school. You'll hear people describe her as a happy young lady, friendly, sweet, and kind. She was well-liked by her peers. She was viewed as mature for her age. She would talk to anyone she considered to be a friendly face. Those in her class, those in the concert choir with her, and those that were in music or on the twirling squad with her. That night, you'll hear that she attended a concert choir banquet at the Sheraton Hotel on the southwest side of Cedar Rapids. She was seen by many people there that night by herself. You'll hear she left the concert choir and went to the Westdale Mall that had just opened in October of 1979, again by herself, to check out a new coat. She was dressed well. She had a rabbit fur coat on. She had a black dress on. You'll hear Michelle was the type of girl, by virtue of the way she looked and her personality, would sometimes attract the attention of older men. Michelle had been dating a young man who had just graduated from Kennedy High School by the name of Mike Wyrick, who at that time was off to Iowa State to attend as a college student. There was another young man with whom she had a previous relationship and with whom she was still friendly that was also a part of her life, Charles Andy Seidel. You'll hear from both of these men, now in their 50s, throughout this case. The evidence that you'll have an opportunity to consider and examine will come from what has been pieced together over the last 40 years since Michelle was murdered. Through the testimony and the evidence in this case, the state will bring to life for all of you a moment in time where numerous young souls converged upon a new and exciting venue in Cedar Rapids on a busy shopping night in December of 1979. As you'll see from their testimony, life went on for the individuals that you'll hear from. We submit to you that when they testify in this case, they will not appear just as witnesses in their late 50s or early 60s, a good chunk of their lifetime behind them. Instead, you'll hear evidence and perceive their testimony through the youthful, gleaming eyes of teenagers in 1979, as folks who had so much life ahead of them and so little behind them at that time, as they speak to you about their interaction with their friend, Michelle Martinko, that night. For a brief period of time in this trial, Michelle will be brought back to life for you to understand what kind of person she was. And the evidence will show you that nobody in her life who knew Michelle would wish any harm upon her at all, nonetheless want to kill her. The evidence will show that just mere moments after these folks interacted with their friend Michelle Martinko, she was killed. You'll hear from witnesses whose life has gone on, but they still hold vivid and tragic memories of her from that night. You'll have an opportunity to assess their credibility, their bias, and their demeanor. And you will consider what it must take to hold visions and memories for 40 years. As I said, you'll hear evidence of Michelle's personality. You'll hear on that night she was dressed to the hilt, black dress, rabbit fur coat. As I said, you'll hear from people who interacted with her that night and knew her well. They will describe how she appeared, and they'll give you a description of her demeanor as well. The stories of their interactions with her are ones that have survived the last 40 years. You'll hear from Kurt Thomas, who knew Michelle, from being in a play with her called Pippin. He saw her that night while he was working at the Chess King at Westdale Mall and took his break to hang out with her for a bit. They went to the Orange Julius, where he grabbed a bite to eat and talked while he was on his break. He will describe to you in vivid detail his recollection of her appearance and her demeanor that night. They spent his break together and then walked back towards the Chess King, where he returned to work. He will testify that she was preparing to leave the mall at that time and indicated as such. Because he had to get back to work, Kurt Thomas bid her goodbye and returned to his workplace. The evidence will show that Kurt Thomas was the last person to speak with Michelle before she was killed. You'll hear from Cheryl Anders, who was outside the mall that night and had arrived to do some shopping at a later hour, right before the mall closed. She saw Michelle leaving the mall in the parking lot, heading towards the general area where her car was found earlier that next morning. The evidence will show that Cheryl Anders was the last person to see Michelle Martinko before she was killed. You'll hear from Phoebe Smith, who was working at Pier 1 Imports at the mall. And after the mall closed for business that night, as she left, she observed Michelle's car, which she had recognized and known was the car that Michelle drove. The car was still parked at Westdale Mall in the same place where Cedar Rapids police officers would later find it and her body inside of it. The evidence will show that when Smith saw that car, unbeknownst to her, Michelle's body lay inside of it, curled into the passenger side seat floorboard, stabbed multiple times, and bloody from the wounds that she sustained. Folks, this case has received a lot of attention, as you're aware. You have taken an oath as jurors to base your decision only on what you hear as evidence in this courtroom. This case has a lot of moving parts. You'll hear from a lot of different people and witnesses. But in the end, the state submits to you that this case centers around what happened to this young lady, Michelle Martinko, forever 18. Michelle's body would later be discovered at approximately 4 o'clock a.m. inside that same car. Deceased. You'll hear from Officer James Kincaid, a career patrol police officer with the Cedar Rapids Police Department. He was called to the scene to check on her and found her body inside the car. You'll hear that he contacted other officers to come to the scene, including ID Officer Richard White. You'll hear from Dick White, who conducted a comprehensive examination of the crime scene, which was limited to the vehicle that Michelle was inside. You'll see photographs taken of the crime scene, and the evidence will show that there was blood everywhere from this attack. The car was seized and analyzed at the Cedar Rapids Police Department, and numerous items were taken as evidence for further examination. The crime scene revealed multiple locations within and on the vehicle showing distinct glove prints, indicating that the suspect was wearing gloves. White was able to find similar gloves that matched the same pattern. This pattern was found on the outside and the inside of the vehicle. The crime scene also revealed that these glove prints were found in areas where there was also blood found, and where the furs from Michelle's rabbit fur coat were also found, again indicating that the individual that had killed her was wearing the same gloves and was the perpetrator of this offense. The evidence will show that the suspect in the case took measures to attempt to conceal their identity, and that as a result, no fingerprints were left behind. But as you will see, in 1979, DNA evidence was not a consideration that entered the minds of suspects or law enforcement. Fortunately, the Cedar Rapids Police Department did take steps to preserve what they could for later analysis that would become available. Specifically, you'll hear that ID Officer Dick White preserved blood scrapings from the gear shift selector of Michelle's vehicle in the dress, the black dress that she wore when she was killed. The evidence will show that these blood scrapings were taken at the time of the initial examination and placed into evidence at the Cedar Rapids Police Department, where they were later accessed in 1997 by another ID officer, Dennis Murphy. The evidence was accessed on a later date on account of the emerging forensic science we now know as DNA profiling and analysis that was beginning to be utilized in an attempt to reveal the source of physical evidence at crime scenes and the identity of the perpetrator. You'll hear from pathologist Richard Feaster, who conducted the autopsy of Michelle Martinko in 1979. From his testimony, you'll hear that she received numerous stab wounds, a stab wound that penetrated her right lung and two that penetrated her left lung. a wound identified as the fatal wound that penetrated her sternum and rib cage and pierced her aorta just above her heart. From his testimony, you'll also learn that she sustained a 3 to 3.5 inch bruise on her head that also had corresponding internal bleeding. The evidence will show she lost 1/3 of her blood capacity and bled to death. From his testimony, you'll hear evidence that based upon the trajectory of her wounds, the assailant was facing her at the time of the attack, that her wounds were consistent with being pushed down on her back and attacked from the front, and that the assailant was on top of her, coming down on her. You'll hear that the amount of force required to inflict these injuries was significant. From his testimony, you'll learn that there was evidence of a struggle and that Michelle sustained numerous defensive wounds to her hands. The evidence will show this was a brutal attack. The evidence will also show this attack was done in a manner that made it very reasonable for the suspect to have cut himself during the attack with the knife used to stab Michelle. You will hear her dress was collected by ID Officer Richard White and in what turned off to be a very auspicious move placed into evidence. You'll hear that for the next 39 years, this investigation continued, and the Cedar Rapids Police Department never closed the case. The evidence will show you that this case may have preceded the development of DNA evidence, and although the nature of forensic examination changed, the evidence that would lead investigators to the suspect who committed this offense remained unchanged. Specifically, the scrapings taken from the gear shift selector and the dress that Michelle wore when she was killed. You will hear that the advancements into science breathed new life into this investigation and provided a glimmer of hope for the investigators. That the answers they sought may lie in the items of physical evidence still remaining from the 1979 crime scene. The evidence will show that in 1997, the Cedar Rapids Police Department submitted numerous items of evidence to the DCI crime lab in Des Moines, Iowa at the time for further analysis in the burgeoning and evolving areas of DNA forensic science. You will hear that as the case continued to be investigated, the evidence was submitted and resubmitted. The gear shift scrapings were submitted in 1997 and again in 2002. The dress was submitted in 1997, again in 2002, again in 2003, and then again in 2005. You will hear from DCI criminalists specializing in DNA forensic science that the items were tested by Michael Peterson, Linda Sawyer, and Michael Schmidt, that DNA forensic analysis ultimately led to the answer that had evaded law enforcement and the survivors of this homicide for years. That in 2002, the dress and the blood scrapings were submitted to the DCI lab and analyzed by criminalist Linda Sawyer. The evidence will show that Linda Sawyer was able to develop a complete, at the time, 15-locus profile from blood on Michelle's dress, believed to be the blood of Michelle. She also analyzed the blood scrapings from the gear shift selector. You will hear she found what she described at the time as a mixture of DNA, with one female, believed to be Michelle, and one male. In 2005, the dress was analyzed again by Linda Sawyer, and she found four more areas on the dress that screened positive for the indication of blood. Three of those stains were believed to be the blood of Michelle Martinko, based upon the comparison made. Another stain, stain number 5, was analyzed and resulted in the development of a partial male DNA profile with complete DNA results at 11 loci and partial results at an additional 2. What does that mean? The evidence will show that means that fewer than 1 in 100 billion individuals would be believed to have this same partial male DNA profile. That means that fewer than 1 in 100 billion individuals would be believed to have the same partial male DNA profile. In other words, the evidence will show this was the individual profile of the male suspect believed to have killed Michelle Martinko. You will hear that the blood of this individual was also found to be consistent with the profile developed from the blood scrapings from the gear shift selector. You will hear that this was the break in the case that the investigators needed to reignite the investigation into this murder. Finally, on account of DNA analysis, investigators now had an identity of a suspect caught and preserved in blood in Michelle's dress that had remained to that point undetected for the prior 26 years. For the next 10 years, Detective Doug Larrison of the Cedar Rapids Police Department and later Investigator Matt Denlinger of the Cedar Rapids Police Department continued to follow up on the case. Over 125 potential suspects were eliminated by the use of DNA profiling in comparison to the suspect male DNA profile from the dress. This will be significant because it will show that the DCI had the ability to affirmatively eliminate suspects as contributors to that profile. Then in 2016, in collaboration with a laboratory out of Virginia called Parabon Nano Labs, Investigator Denlinger explored new techniques in lead generation and development, including the use of DNA phenotyping, snapshot, and kinship analysis to attempt to narrow down the potential suspect who was the source of the suspect male DNA profile. In 2018, with the assistance of Parabon, a computerized file containing the raw data of the suspect DNA was uploaded to a website called GEDmatch. And through the use of genetic genealogy to find potential relatives of that suspect profile, Investigator Denlinger narrowed down the lead generation to three brothers from Manchester, Iowa, just 45 minutes from Cedar Rapids, where Michelle was killed. Donald Burns, Kenneth Burns, and the defendant in this case, Jerry Burns. You'll hear that investigators then developed a plan to collect covert DNA from these individuals, and that on October 29th, 2018, Investigator Denlinger collected a straw used by the defendant at a pizza ranch in Manchester, Iowa, and sent it to the DCI crime lab in Ankeny. The evidence will show that comparison of the DNA that was able to be obtained from the straw used by the defendant and the suspect male DNA profile from Michelle's dress revealed an outstanding development. For the first time in the investigation of any suspect, the defendant could not be eliminated as the major contributor to this profile. In other words, DNA from this straw was found to be similar to the DNA at the crime scene. Meanwhile, the covert DNA collected from his brothers resulted in those items being eliminated as suspects, like the previous 125 or so that had been compared. The evidence will show that a subsequent known buccal swab collected from the defendant himself and compared to the suspect male DNA profile resulted in another outstanding finding. The suspect male DNA profile from Michelle's dress was consistent with the known DNA profile of the defendant at every possible loci where results could be obtained and compared. The evidence known DNA profile was found to be the same as the suspect male DNA profile. The evidence will show, in other words, the probability of finding this profile in a population of unrelated individuals chosen at random would be less than 1 in 100 billion. In other words, the evidence will show in a population of unrelated individuals, 100 billion, more than 12 times the world population, the chances of finding this profile would be less than 1 in 100 billion. In other words, they found their guy. The evidence will show that the later testing that was performed on the blood scrapings taken from the gear shift selector resulted in finding a partial male DNA profile that was also compared to the known profile of the defendant. This resulted in a finding that was not quite as high as 1 in 100 billion because it wasn't a full DNA sample, but a finding that was impressive nonetheless. What was found with regard to the partial male DNA profile developed from the blood shift selector was that it too was similar in comparison to the defendant's known DNA. The probability of choosing at random a similar profile to the extent that the defendant's DNA compared similarly to the DNA on the gear shift selector in a population of individuals was 1 in 1,773. In other words, you'll find the evidence will show you can only find that similar profile in 0.0564% of individuals. The evidence will show that, in addition to the dress revealed these findings, the dress being 1 in 100 billion. In other words, the evidence will show investigators found their guy, not in one place, but two. The evidence will show in this case that for 39 years, the answers that so many sought lied in a spot and a scraping, although however microscopic, the story that the DNA possessed told enormous information. The information and the science led investigators to one man, the defendant. You will hear that when the evidence led investigators to the defendant, he was approached and interviewed by law enforcement on the 39th anniversary of Michelle's death. You will hear that when investigators interviewed him, before he was told that there was DNA on the scene, they were able to gain the following information from him. The defendant claimed he did not know Michelle Martinko. He said he did not remember seeing her and that he was not there when she was murdered. He said he had lived in Manchester his whole life. The evidence will show he said he never worked in Cedar Rapids but was working as a salesman in Elkader in 1979 for John Deere. The defendant claimed he had no reason to be in Cedar Rapids and that he never worked at the Westdale Mall. You'll hear that investigators told the defendant they found DNA at the crime scene. You'll hear they, as I've already said, obtained a sample of his DNA. Then, after the defendant was arrested, he continued to talk. You'll hear that investigator Denlinger was speaking to the defendant and told him, "Help me understand what was going through your mind." The evidence will show the defendant responded, "I don't recollect." Investigator Denlinger said, "Do you think it's possible this happened and you don't remember?" The evidence will show, "I don't know. I'm sure something like that would be possible to block out," the defendant said. Investigator Denlinger said, "Yeah, it could be possible to black out." And the defendant, the evidence will show, corrected him and said, "For somebody to block out, you block things out of your memories." Investigator Denlinger asked how everything was going at that time. The defendant stated, "I don't know. I don't know. Nothing stands out." The evidence will show Investigator Denlinger stated to him, "You're an old man, a whole world apart, right?" And the evidence will show the defendant responded, "Yeah." And the evidence will show Investigator Denlinger said, "Wish you could go back there and talk some sense into that kid. Help me understand." And the defendant said, "I don't know." The end of that interview, the defendant told Investigator Denlinger that he respected the police, that they had a tough job. Through the use of DNA profiling and through the evidence you will hear in this case, you will find that the evidence in this case may be microscopic, but actually you will learn that the smaller we go, the closer we get to the science that explains life and our existence in the universe. The evidence will show that DNA is literally what makes us who we are, 1 in 8 billion, or in this case, 1 in 100 billion. You will hear that DNA is what separates us from each other, our blueprint in the vast universe in which we live. The evidence will show that our DNA is our blueprint, evidence of our own existence, often at a certain place in time. It's the footprint we leave, and the evidence will show that in certain cases, it can stand the test of time. Ladies and gentlemen, in short, the evidence will show that Michelle Martinko was murdered that night by the defendant, Jerry Burns. As you will see, the evidence in this case will show this was a very precise area of attack. The nature of the crime itself will be evidence of premeditation and the specific intent to kill. The evidence not revealing any suspect in 1979 who knew Michelle being the perpetrator of this offense, the evidence will show instead of a murder driven by greed, retaliation, or knowledge of a victim, or a reason to kill the person, this was a random act of violence committed by a stranger. This will explain, and the evidence will show, this is why no connection was developed between the defendant and Ms. Martinko. This will explain why it took 40 years in DNA to solve. The evidence will show, and this will explain why the defendant was not on the radar of law enforcement. The evidence will show and explain this wasn't an ex, this wasn't a suitor, wasn't anyone she knew. It was the random guy. As a result, the evidence will explain why this crime was and still is shocking. At the end of this case, we will return to you. We will review the evidence that has been received in this case, and we will ask you to enter a verdict of guilty of murder in the first degree. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Maybank.
Next, we'll hear from attorney Leon Spies, a dapper-looking gentleman with snow-white hair and a matching mustache. Spies had a successful track record of defending people in criminal cases, and, as he would argue, there may have been room for reasonable doubt in this case. Spies introduced the theory that DNA contamination may be to blame for Jerry Byrne's DNA profile seeming to match that of the killer. Let's hear Leon Spies' opening statement in the trial right now.
At the coffee shop, you bought a coffee. You put your hand on the counter. You may have got a cold drink from a convenience store and drunk that drink from a straw. You may have used a public restroom in the courthouse and touched the faucet, touched the lavatory. You may have shaken hands with another member of the jury. What we're going to learn over the course of the next couple of weeks is that in each of those acts, we leave a trail. We leave a trail of our biologic specimens. We leave trails of DNA. In addition to the trails that we leave, we also cross trails of other people that we meet throughout the course of the day. Someone who may have coughed, put their hand on a bus handle, may have sneezed, may have spilled something on a bench, may have brushed up against us, shaken our hand. In each of those instances, not only do we have a trail, but they have left a trail that intersects with us. What you're going to hear over the next couple of weeks is that those trails tell us what we are, but they don't necessarily tell us who we are or where we've been. There's no question that the Cedar Rapids Police Department and law enforcement in the investigation of this horrifying death were determined and pursued leads best available to them at the time, and no one is going to be critical of that determination, and no one in this courtroom at any point is going to be critical of Michelle Martinko. There was no reason for her to die, and there was no reason for any violence to be inflicted upon her. But the evidence is also going to show that at some stage, this investigation was diverted. It too took a trail. And we're going to demonstrate to you that we believe that the diversion of this trail led to investigators believing that Jerry Byrnes was the killer of Michelle Martinko. In fact, when he was questioned in December of 2018 on the anniversary of Michelle Martinko's death, it should come as no surprise that he could not say where he was on that date in 1979 at a well-traveled mall, a busy commercial area in Cedar Rapids, Iowa. In 1979, the evidence will show that Jerry Byrnes was a married man. He was living with his wife and his two young children in Manchester, Iowa, the town in which he was born and raised, where his family had farmed, where he had eventually established a successful business. He could not identify where he had been in 1979, and the construction, given that he made some admission en route from Manchester, Iowa to Cedar Rapids, is a spin that is not accurate. Even though we are going to hear, as you've heard this morning, some dramatic statistics about DNA and correlations of DNA and consistency of DNA and DNA that cannot be eliminated, those statistics, men and women of the jury, are only as accurate as the investigation on which they are founded. They're only as accurate as the integrity of that investigation, the consistency and the care with which the items that DNA was collected from were handled throughout the course of the past 40 years. They can tell us a lot about what can be discerned and what cannot be discerned. But it's going to be very important for us throughout the course of this trial to be sure to recognize what those numbers mean and, more importantly, what they do not mean. We're going to have a distinguished forensic scientist who's going to help you and help us not only understand what those numbers mean, but also about the integrity of the investigation from which those numbers were drawn. You're going to hear, and our expert will demonstrate to you, an expert not only on genetic science and genetic investigation, but also on crime scene investigation, that the handling of the evidence, the likelihood of the intersection of trails of complete strangers, demonstrate that the trails do not inevitably lead to Jerry Lynn Byrnes. Those divergent paths, I repeat, do not inevitably lead to Jerry Lynn Byrnes. And those scientific paths also demonstrate why it cannot be said not only that Jerry Lynn Byrnes was not the killer of Michelle Martinko, but they will also demonstrate that Jerry Lynn Byrnes is not guilty of the killing of Michelle Martinko.
These powerful opening statements from both the prosecution and the defense paint two polar opposite stories of Jerry Byrnes' role in the murder of Michelle Martinko.
investigators had DNA at the scene, and DNA does not lie. While we know that DNA evidence is irrefutable, could that DNA have been contaminated somehow? What are your thoughts? If you're not following me on Instagram, please do, and let's continue the conversation there at True Crime IRL, all one word. I want to hear what you guys have to say. And next time on True Crime IRL, we're going to hear more about Jerry Byrne's trial for the murder of Michelle Martinko. And we're going to get into that damning internet search history that the jury members would never get to hear. Until next time, lock your doors, people. Bye-bye. True Crime IRL is written, produced, and hosted by Kelly Barons Brink. Please subscribe to True Crime IRL wherever you get your podcasts and consider leaving a 5-star review. Go to truecrimeirl.com for more information. Support the show by becoming a Patreon donor. Go to patreon.com/truecrimeirlpodcast. You can also support the show by leaving a tip in the TCIRL tip jar. Go to truecrimeirl.com and click on the donate button. Or buy merch in the TCIRL merch shop. truecrimeirl.com/merch. Watch True Crime IRL on YouTube at youtube.com/KellyBrinkTV. Be sure to follow us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at True Crime IRL, all one word. True Crime IRL theme music is produced by The Captain at True Crime Garage.